Welcome everyone to this exciting live Twitter AMA session. Today we have two, without a doubt, brilliant minds in the crypto space joining us to shed light on some crucial topics regarding the security in crypto. So please give a warm welcome to Dima Budorin, CEO of Hacken, and Jameson Lopp, the CTO of CasaHall. Thank you both for being here today. And before we dive into the discussion, Dima, Jameson, could you please introduce yourselves and give our audience a brief overview of your roles in your companies and your journey in the crypto industry overall?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you. Hello, everyone. My role at Hacken is the CEO. We were 6 years at the market, launched in 2017. Mostly we do cybersecurity services, but also we build some products that automate and make some processes, security processes, and make less hacks in the industry. We also do ratings of security space that boosts awareness of best and bad practices. And we are proud Ukrainians, but live now in Lisbon. My previous job was I was a senior manager 8 years at Deloitte.
Awesome. Thank you, Dima.
Right. So as for myself, I got interested in Bitcoin about a decade ago and pretty quickly jumped in and started doing some of my own just sort of side projects trying to better understand this space. And within a couple of years, decided I was interested enough that I would go full time. I spent those first 3 years working at a company called BitGo. And I was basically helping build infrastructure that would help exchanges and other large custody providers improve the security of their hot wallets. Essentially, in the early days of Bitcoin, what we saw happen quite often was exchanges, running essentially all of the money of their clients off of a single signature wallet that was usually, on a server somewhere. So if a hacker got through their defenses, they would just wipe everybody out. And often the exchange would, have to close, go into bankruptcy. So we were trying to facilitate improved best practices there by letting these exchanges have multiple keys and, different security footprints so that it would, reduce the ability for a hacker to just go in and wipe everything out. And over the years, I learned a lot more about best practices because we saw people screw up in many different ways, and eventually decided that what I wanted to do was do a slight pivot. And I basically took a lot of that knowledge and best practices and started CASA. And really, CASA is a similar type of security service where instead we're targeting mostly individuals and trying to help people get themselves into a self-custody setup that is not only foolproof against hackers and against all types of different loss, but also it's flexible enough that the user can be human and that they can make mistakes and they can be confident that if something goes wrong, it won't be a catastrophe that will cause them to lose all of their money. And this is really, I think, a very important thing for us to continue working on in this space. Like if we really want to get to a level of mass adoption where people are actually being their own bank, we need for people to be confident that they can be their own bank. And that means we need to have, better user experiences, better safeguards, if you will, so that the average user doesn't need to be highly technical and need to spend a ton of their time understanding what all the best practices are and what every possible thing is that could go wrong and could make them lose money. So really for the past 5 years now, I've been the CTO at Casa, helping to architect our solutions, you know, both all the way from the protocol level of what we're using at Bitcoin and now Ethereum as well, to help facilitate what we believe the best practices are and the best security architecture are, you know, all the way up to the user interface level of, you know, how do we provide a nice, you know, mobile app experience that is giving people security, but is also guiding them in such a way that they don't have to know all of the technical details of what's going on under the hood. So, you know, it's been a long and arduous process. And as I think we're going to get into today, we are really far away from the finish line. Like, this is still a highly dynamic environment where there's still a lot of lessons to be learned and there's still a lot of room for improvement.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm glad you touched this topic, because that is something that I actually wanted to start with, is like the industry itself. We are already 15 years from Bitcoin white paper release, right? And the first ICO happened 9 years ago. And, you know, a lot of things has been changing, developing. People started from having their all their Bitcoins on their hard drives. Then, you know, there were some exchanges or some wallets. And overall, the security has been also maturing. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, there was almost no such notion as like a smart contract audit or something. It was something very rare to stumble upon. But now any respectable project kind of needs this, some kind of protection, and not only for having credibility, but also from the standpoint of securing its users' assets. So we have a lot of emerging things that already are established in the industry, such as audits, like penetration testings, back bounty programs. But where are we at right now exactly from the Northern Star? Is there any obvious areas of security and self-custody that still require standardization or improvement? Or what's your idea on the current state of the security and self-custody, guys?
I wanted to make a little step back, because and that touched base the topic of BitGo. And Jameson, you've been watching first major exchange collapse, and since then, after MTGOX collapsed, there were a lot of discussions about proof of reserve and how to prove that exchanges were solvent and that they were not playing around with user funds. And as you said, you saw that a lot of exchanges started to use third-party custody. But unfortunately, we see that there was one spike of this trend after the MTGOX. Then we have one spike after the Quadriga CX, that people started to care about what are the balances of exchanges. And recently we also had the same story, that some exchanges started to kind of proof of their reserves, but I see that again this topic is not hot anymore. My question is, how many do you think exchanges, do you have approximation, are using third-party custody, and how many of them do not touch base the do not touch user funds, and they are basically solvent?
Yeah, well, I haven't worked at BitGo in many years, but I would suspect that, you know, probably especially if you look at the long tail of exchanges, because there's a lot of really tiny exchanges out there. Like in terms of just raw numbers of exchanges, I bet the majority of them are using a custody solution that, it may not be fully trusted third party, but at least involves a third party, because, you know, it takes a lot of time and resources to implement a good custody solution. So in many cases, unless you're a huge exchange, that's one of the things where it at least makes sense to outsource the technology stack. And then, of course, there's sometimes regulatory issues, and sometimes you want to outsource the whole thing and you want to just fully trust a third party to custody it. You know, that is something that BitGo realized as I was working there back in like the 2017 era, and they spent several years forming a trust company. And so they ended up offering not only a self-custody sort of facilitated multi-sig setup, but ended up offering a full-on qualified custodian offerings as well, because they knew that there was a market for that. Even though I'm personally not a fan of going down that route, you know, there are use cases where it's unfortunately required. You know, how many exchanges are solvent? That is the sort of perennial question. And unfortunately, the really tricky thing is that proof of reserves are not a panacea. Like it's not even really a baked standard at this point. And this is something that came up, you know, with the recent issues with stuff around like the last wave of collapses with FTX and Celsius and whatnot. We had renewed interest from people for the cryptocurrency certification consortium to kind of better define the proof of reserve controls within the security standard. And once we started getting into the nitty gritty of it, because we rolled out this audit capability fairly recently, earlier this year, we essentially discovered that it was too difficult for us to have a specific way of doing proof of reserves. And the short version for the reason behind that is that it's not merely the issue of like proving cryptographic control of funds. You know, that is better than nothing. It proves that you have some funds, but the whole point of proof of reserves is, like you said, is to prove that the exchange or custodian has not been rehypothecating or dipping into or otherwise, abusing their clients' funds. And that means there is another aspect of that, which is the proof of liabilities. And really, there's no standard that I'm aware of that really solves the proof of liabilities issue. And that's usually, at least in part, because you have to bring in yet another party, preferably some sort of disinterested accountant who will be doing things at arm's length. And of course, that involves yet another point of trust. So, it got so gnarly that point that I'm getting to is that we actually dropped the proof of reserves control from the security standard recently. And really, we've settled on the fact that the cryptocurrency security standard is really meant to be about how you create, store, manage, and use the actual private key material. And the idea is that, if you're doing all of that correctly, then the rest of the stuff should generally fall into place. Now, as we've seen, fraud, on the other hand, is kind of a completely different issue. And that, I think, is something that's not going to be solved by cryptographic security standards. Rather, that there's already a whole industry for that. And, you know, that's why you have reputable third-party accountants come in. Of course, I think we've seen plenty of examples with FTX, for example, where they, I think they just lied to their auditors, if I recall correctly. So, you know, I don't unfortunately have a sort of a trustless solution that I think we can point to really help people be confident that there's no fraud going on. And the short version of like, how do you deal with all of this is like, this is what self-custody is for. You don't need to have, you know, complex sets of controls and accounting stuff on third parties if your money is not with a third party. Like, you take control of your money and do your own accounting, and that is the best security architecture that is available in this space.
Yeah, I was also part of the of this working group and also was participating on the discussion of removal proof of reserve from the standards. I think it was slightly changed the angle, like proof of controls, so that the custody doesn't have the access to client funds. But yeah, I agree that if to like include accounting points into the standard, that will, the standard will be massive and very difficult for exchanges to follow. Hopefully that C4 will put a new effort to write the standard for the proof of reserve as well. Is this planned?
At the moment, I think we basically decided that it was too difficult of a problem to try to address. I mean, like you said, we had those groups and a lot of discussions around it, and there were just so many different points that each one kind of chipped away at the trustworthiness of going to the trouble of doing all of this. For one aspect, like even if you got a good proof of reserve system, and you know, we have seen a few exchanges implement their own variations of proof of reserves. And I think what we've seen is very few, maybe even none of them, are actually doing real-time proof of reserves. It's usually a point-in-time audit. You know, maybe it's twice a year, once a quarter, whatever. And so, you know, even then, like, what is the guarantee that you're getting? Even if you have a perfect proof of reserve system, it's showing you that, you know, they have the money at that time, but there's always going to be ways to game it. You know, I think we talked through a number of issues of like, well, what if they just move a bunch of money in to their setup and do the proof of reserve and then move it back out again? And, you know, you don't really know what's happening to the money. So I keep falling back on this idea that, you know, the only way to really be sure of what's going on with your money is to hold it yourself.
That's a brilliant point, honestly. As once some smart people said, not your keys, not your crypto. Yeah. So just overall, we touched the CCSS, the standard. For those who may not of what's the CCSS? What's the cryptocurrency security standard? And why is it a standard? Like, is anyone following it?
Right. So, you know, I believe this was originally formed, it was back around like 2016 or so. And I know Mike Belshi, the CEO of BitGo, was one of the founding members, along with a number of other names that I'm sure people will recognize. And the idea was that we kept seeing these catastrophic failures happen in the space, and it's kind of a recurring cycle, right? Is that some, you know, people and companies come along, they get into the space, they kind of create their own patchwork solution, and it's often implemented poorly. And then if they're successful and they get to a point where they have a significant amount of money in their system, you know, that's a bug bounty. And eventually, if there are security vulnerabilities, they'll be exploited and basically cleaned out. So this cycle seems to repeat every few years, and people don't learn lessons from the past, you know, perhaps just due to sheer ignorance. And so the idea was, you know, we've learned a lot of lessons. We should write them down, and we should make them specific enough that someone can follow them. And so I think and I hope that, you know, most of the custodians in the space are familiar with the standard, and they are probably following large parts of the standard. It's the standard itself is about, you know, 35 to 40 specific control points, and these control points that cover a number of different areas. The actual seed generation, you know, the creation of the private keys for the setup, the ongoing storage of those keys, the specific protocols for how the keys get used to sign transactions, because of course, anytime you're handling key material, there's a number of things that can go wrong. It involves creating key compromise policies of, you know, exactly what do you do if one of the keys in your system is no longer trustworthy? Then there's just sort of a lot of internal controls around, like, how do you actually decide and grant and revoke access to humans who are going to be handling key material? How do you do security audits and tests? How do you handle just the data of the system itself and make sure that sensitive data gets sanitized, and how do you ensure that you have strong audit logs so that if something does go wrong, you can be sure that you'll be able to do, you know, forensic analysis so that you can figure out, you know, exactly what compromise occurred so that you can, you know, repair your system and continue going forward. I mean, that is, you know, something that you know, any sophisticated attacker is going to do is try to wipe out all of the audit trails as they are performing the attack. So, you know, the idea is that if you're following these controls, you're going to be putting yourself in a much better position. And, you know, each control, we have like three different levels. It's sort of level one, level two, level three of like exactly how extreme and paranoid are you going to be about these controls. So as of today, you know, we just rolled out the actual auditor program. I think we have one or two audits in flight. We've had like one company that's actually gotten all the way through the audit process. But basically last year we rolled out the testing so that anyone who wants to can learn all of these controls and then can take a test to get certified to be an auditor. Essentially, you can have your name on the list of if a custodian wants to have their system verified and certified, you can, you know, be one of the people who actually performs that and, you know, charges for that service. And, you know, when an audit happens, there will be a peer review. So it's not just one auditor. You know, we don't want to have single points of failure there. And this is something that we would like to see more and more companies go through the audit process, because, you know, it does provide, I think, more trustworthiness, stronger reputation for these custodians, because they're all black boxes. You know, if you're using an exchange, if you're using, you know, some service that you have to send your money into, as soon as you send those funds, you really have no idea what potential vulnerabilities those funds are now open to. So, you know, if we have more entities in this space that are essentially proving themselves to be following the highest level of standards that are available, then this should reduce the likelihood that more of these catastrophes happen. And I think that's good for the entire space in general. Like, anyone who's been around for a few cycles knows that when we have these boom and bust cycles and these catastrophes that happen, it can take years for us to recover from that sort of global reputation loss. And, I think we're over a year now from the last sort of wave of failures. It could be another few years before we're back to where we were before all of those things went wrong.
Yes, thank you for explaining the CSS standard. Actually, my 2023 started with getting this certification. I get it on the 1st of January, and I challenged our hacking team to do it as well. And I think we have around 15, 18 CCSS auditors in the team. And we've been actively promoting the standards to our clients, to our partners. And we see that still we need to invest a lot of time and efforts into market education, because other custody providers, they see, of course, that the Fireblocks was the pioneer who received the standard, but they, for some reasons, they don't want to do this extra step to prove people that they are secure enough. Their motivation is that, okay, we done SOC 2 and we done ISO 27001, and that should be fairly enough. Jimson, can you please maybe tell some more information why the CCSS standard is given more trust and covering more risks rather than the SOC 2 and ISO certifications?
Right. I mean, there is some overlap there, and CCSS was born out of the idea that, there are various standards that already exist for securing private key material, but none of them, to my knowledge, they haven't really been updated for the times. They haven't been updated for using private keys to manage bearer assets. So there was essentially a gaping hole in the best practices for this specific use case. Interestingly enough, the cryptocurrency certification consortium is going to be having a podcast in about an hour and a half now, and it's specifically entitled why SOC 2 isn't enough for Web 3. It's standards are tough. They're tough to develop, and then even once you develop them, it's even harder to actually get them adopted. As you, I think, have seen yourself, it's an odd kind of incentives problem of like, we know this is the right thing to do, but I think a lot of people are looking, or at least a lot of organizations, they're looking at it and they're like, all right, so you want us to spend thousands of dollars to be a sort of early adopter of this standard. And I think it's kind of a chicken and egg or a network effect problem of, once you get it bootstrapped and you get some large reputable names behind it, then you kind of have a sort of social pressure, if you will. This is the kind of thing where it needs to start popping up on checkboxes for other companies. When they're going around and they're looking for custody solutions, they should be asking the question, are you CCSS certified? And if, in a B2B environment, the salespeople learn very quickly that if they can't check off the boxes that are the sort of requirements for potential clients, they're going to lose the deal. They're not even probably going to get very far in the conversation. And so very quickly, those requirements get passed down to the engineering aspect of the organization to figure out how they can implement them. So, I think that's where we are right now in this phase, is trying to figure out how do we get it bootstrapped and start getting that level of pressure so that people don't just wave their hands and say that SOC 2 is enough. I'm not deeply versed in SOC 2 aspects, but it always seemed to me like it was heavier on the auditing aspect. It was just making sure that you understand how your internal systems work and that you have strong audit trails for what's happening inside of the system. It's about controlling information, but it's not necessarily very well geared towards protecting private key material. So, SOC 2 is still good. I don't think it's good enough if you're going to be managing bearer assets that can be stolen in a matter of milliseconds and then are impossible to get back.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. In 2018 at Hacking, we came from the traditional cybersecurity Web2, and our main question was why do we have so many exchange hacks, and we started to research the landscape of cryptocurrency exchanges security, and we identified that a lot of exchanges, they don't do penetration tests, bug bounties, and they follow quite weak security practices. And we created the ranking of security of exchanges, and that ranking was integrated into CoinGecko Trust Score. And then exchanges who didn't follow the best security practices, basically their score at CoinGecko has fallen and then they start to see that they're losing people trust, and then they started to do regular pen tests and bug bounties. So from our experience, people at projects are starting to pay attention to cybersecurity in three cases: when they got hacked, then it's too late; when they are pushed by regulators, and right now I don't see how regulators on the global level can make exchanges to do this or that things. And the third, which is the most important, is when they are losing revenue. So basically, getting the bad markets top crypto aggregator that's saying that you are not doing the pen tests, it affected them, and they in fact started to do the pen tests, and as a result, we see less exchange hacks. So just one last thing on the CCSS. I know that there is a first exchange who is completing their certification, and once this exchange will have the CCSS, we will update our methodology at ser.life, and we will put CCSS as required standard. So hopefully that will create the demands, and exchanges will start following this practice. Jameson, can you please tell who else who else is recommended to do CCSS? Like exchanges, custodial wallets, who else, in your opinion?
Yeah, so like I said, there are dozens of controls, and I would say any self-custody setup can benefit at least from the first few sections of the CCSS. Basically, how do you create the private keys and store them and manage them and use them? the sort of second half of controls of CCSS are more organization specific, and it's more, you know, internal controls of how you manage the humans and how they access the keys themselves. So, you know, that's less applicable to, say, like a sole self-custody setup where it's just one person who's, you know, taking care of their own keys. But in general, you know, I would say it's something that anyone who is managing their own custody should look into. And if you're custodying, you know, money for other people, you should definitely look into it, because, you know, it's not, you're taking risks that are putting, you know, assets other than just yours on the line. So at the end of the day, I think everyone should at least look at it. And you, whether or not you go through the trouble of getting an audit, you know, that's something I think will mainly be relegated to larger businesses, because this is something that, you know, will have a significant cost to go through the whole audit process. But, you know, you can, for example, take tests on the CCSS website that can show that you have a good understanding of what the standard is, and then essentially implement as many controls as you're comfortable with. The one thing that I would really try to impart from all of this is that you don't necessarily have to meet, you know, level 2 or level 3 of all of the controls. Even if you don't meet level 1 of all of the controls, you're probably putting yourself in a better position than 99% of the custody setups out there. So, you know, every additional security measure that you are implementing, of course, is going to, you know, increase your posture, your resilience. And it is kind of arbitrary of if you get to a specific level or not. It's just you know, a very rough measure of how robust your setup is. But, you know, anything is better than nothing.
Sorry. To wrap up the topic about the standards, what other standards do we need in Web3 industry, in your opinion?
Well, it gets really complicated. You know, for the past 7 or 8 years now, CCSS, like we've said, really just focuses on the private key management. You know, even when we ran into the proof of reserve stuff, that basically proved to be a bit too complicated for us to try to standardize. And now you're talking about using much more complex smart contracts. The attack surface on those goes up significantly because the complexity goes up significantly. So, you know, this is something that the sort of Web3 ecosystem has also been working on over the years. And I believe, you know, if you look at the landscape of theft and loss over the past few years, the sort of types of loss that we've seen have changed. So we already talked about how, you know, in the first decade or so of this industry, the majority of losses tended to be one-off exploits at large centralized exchanges, essentially, you know, wiping out all of the money that they were keeping, usually in hot wallets. Then over the years, you know, we developed better standards, and it seems like the majority of exchanges have at least learned not to keep all of their clients' funds in a hot wallet, and, you know, they're only keeping a few percent in a hot wallet and the rest in some sort of cold storage setup. So that has greatly reduced the, you know, catastrophic loss and exchange failures, at least of the honest exchanges that, you know, don't commit fraud and rug pull their users. And so now it seems like the biggest hacks and losses that are occurring are on the smart contract side. So whether that is happening at the, like, the token bridges or happening at the decentralized exchange, smart contracts, really any smart contract that is now interacting with arbitrarily complex other users and other smart contracts, where we're seeing the sophisticated attackers really exploiting vulnerabilities in the smart contracts themselves, finding edge cases that just were overlooked by the smart contract developer. And in many cases, these edge cases can similarly be exploited to drain most, if not all, of the funds that are being secured by that smart contract. So, we have seen some standards get implemented, or at least get agreed upon by some large names. There is the Enterprise Ethereum Alliance has been working on standards for how to write smart contracts. I think there's also been improvements on tooling around being able to analyze smart contracts. And of course, an entire industry of smart contract auditors has bloomed. Now, of course, audits aren't perfect in and of themselves. I think we've seen a few exploits happen against contracts that had been audited. But once again, having an audit is better than not having an audit.
Thank you. Thank you. I shared the link to ETH Trust security standard from EEA. And for those developers who are listening right now, I really recommend to look at it. And there is valuable information on what can be done on the development phase so that it doesn't mean that you shouldn't have an audit, but it means that you will already cover some risk by following the standard. All right, let's switch to account abstraction. A lot of people hear this word, but they know that this is something good for the industry, something good for mass adoption. But I think people still don't understand the difference between custody, non-custody, and account abstraction. Think how to set up the wallet. Can you please explain it in simple words, what it is and how it will affect on the mass adoption and how it will affect on the user experience?
Yeah, it can be tricky to talk about for several reasons. But the short version is that in an EVM type of protocol like Ethereum, there are generally two different types of accounts or different types of ways of storing your money. And the sort of default one is this externally owned account or EOA. This is basically a single signature type of account. And this is the only type of account that can actually kick off the execution of a smart contract. And it can be pretty limiting in what you can do with it. So generally, what happens is someone comes into the ecosystem. If they're going into self-custody, then they first have to deposit some money into one of these very simple externally owned accounts. And then if they want to do more complex smart contracting stuff, they have to send the money from there to some other smart contract. And it gets additionally complicated because something has to pay the gas fees to execute those smart contracts. And so as of today, you have to continue to maintain an ETH balance in your EOA account to be able to pay for those fees, or you have to be able to delegate a sort of fee relayer mechanism from some other externally owned account to pay those fees. So what is account abstraction? It's basically a way of describing a grab bag of different functionality that a number of people would like to see happen to these EVM accounts. And some of the things that that would involve is that it would give you more flexibility around some of the security rules you could implement. It could give you more redundancy around recovering your account if you lose the private key. It can improve the sort of gas paying experience and potentially even let you pay the gas with things, tokens other than ETH itself. And also should help improve the ability to do batching of transactions. In general, this is something where I think it would help merge the ideas of this single external account and smart contracts. And so essentially you would have one account and it would do everything. And the reason it can get tricky is that it's not really clear how this is going to happen. There are a number of different improvement proposals out there. And I think the one most people talk about is this EIP-4337, which is basically a way of implementing most of the functionality where you don't actually have to change the protocol. Now, right now, there are a number of like layer two solutions that have implemented this. I know that Gnosis Safe, which is what Casa has built our Ethereum multi-sig solution on, they've implemented a lot of the functionality, but in general, it seems to be still a kind of like use at your own risk. It's not a fully fleshed out standard. And then there's, I think, three other EIPs out there for ways that this could be implemented at the protocol level. So, you know, it's hard to say, you know, when is account abstraction going to be a fully baked thing. It still seems to be in a sort of research and development phase. But the idea is just, you know, simplicity and more extensibility and flexibility of what you can do you know, without having all of the complexity of what we're seeing right now, which, you know, this has been tricky for us to implement it at Casa because we can't just offer one single account for people to do everything that they want.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And yeah, so please tell us what is the alternative. Please tell us how Casa is built and what is the philosophy behind it.
Yeah, so, you know, and a number of the pieces of functionality that, that people generally lump into account abstraction are actually things that Casa has offered for a number of years, though, you know, this functionality is not actually happening at the protocol level necessarily, but rather, you know, Casa's core functionality is offering a multi-signature solution, which basically means that, you know, instead of having one key and one signature required to be able to authorize the spending of funds, you create three keys or five keys, and then you need either two signatures or three signatures to be able to fully authorize the spending of those funds. This was fairly straightforward to implement on Bitcoin because, you know, OpCheck multisig has been a part of the Bitcoin protocol since, I think, 2013 or 2014. However, there is no, you know, native multi-signature functionality in the EVM. If you want that, you actually have to write and deploy a smart contract in order to enable it. So I was actually at BitGo when they went through the whole process of writing their own multi-signature smart contract, and it took over a year. You know, not the actual writing of the contract, you know, that probably took a day or two. Rather, what took so long was getting a sufficient level of review and audits and kind of stepping up the quote unquote bug bounty on the contract by, you know, depositing more and more funds into it. And, you know, seeing the audits coming back, I think we had three or four different audits over that year long period, and seeing all of the edge cases that people kept finding, it was a very scary experience. And it was something, you know, I didn't want to go through at Casa. You know, we didn't want to become smart contract developers in general. Casa does not want to implement novel things. We want to implement solutions that have been vetted and somewhat standardized, but in many cases, they're just, you know, too complicated for the average person to implement. And we just want to make it easier for people to follow the best practices. So, you know, having the ability to do things like have multiple keys in multiple locations, or to be able to recover from a loss, you know, if you have a key that gets compromised and you want to be able to just replace it and continue moving on without suffering from funds loss. Now, these are things that we've baked into our setup for a number of years. But at the Bitcoin level, most of those things, the way that they were implemented is really because Casa is a coordinator. So while we are doing, you know, quote unquote smart contracts at the Bitcoin and now the Ethereum level, you know, we're leveraging the protocol functionality. The way that we actually, you know, facilitate a lot of this is by the fact that, you know, we're offering an app that gives us some additional control and gating over, you know, exactly how some of the keys are being used and authorized. And, you know, an example around that is that Casa holds one key of every setup. You can think of us as a emergency recovery cosigner, for example. And then we create additional authentication protocols around how you request that. But, you know, these things are not done within the actual cryptographic asset protocol network. It's done out of band, you know, between yourself and Casa. So it's nice now that you know, we've deployed on the Gnosis Safe smart contract for Ethereum, which has been in operation for a number of years and is storing, I believe, tens of billions of dollars worth of assets. So we're quite confident in, you know, using that as a sort of foundational aspect of our platform on Ethereum. And then we're just building the rest of our interfaces and controls around that. So we have, of course, run into some complexities just due to the, you know, lack of account abstraction functionality that we've talked about earlier. And that has, you know, resulted in us having to facilitate, for example, some of the paying of gas for transactions, which, you know, we would prefer that would all sort of happen under the hood automatically. But, you know, that is, for example, some additional complexity that now Casa is managing on behalf of our users, simply because it's necessary. But, you know, we would very much like to be able to get rid of that complexity and let the user just be using the protocol more directly.
Yeah, I agree. Like the main one of the main thing of like account abstraction is how the user can recover his funds if he lost an access, and if there is a solution where you don't have extra fees when working with this wallet when you are doing it with the like the private key recovery as in Casa key architecture rather than through the smart contract, like it's more reasonable to do because like why to pay more fees. I have one question. Vitalik Buterin is pushing hard to have social recoveries of the private keys in the case of loss. What do you think about it? And do you like this idea? You don't like this idea?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, we've heard the term social recovery get thrown around for a number of years. And it makes me cringe, mainly because of the vagueness of it. I'm sure that there will be setups that will be fairly sound. So, you know, like I already mentioned, you know, one of Casa's functionalities that we offer is it's really a key recovery service. But, you know, when you're implementing key recoveries, You then need to implement authentication protocols to make sure that that key recovery itself is not a potential point of failure and exploitation. So, you know, the reason that it makes me cringe, it really comes down to sort of game theory and what I have seen from, you know, average cryptocurrency users over the past 10 years. And mainly I question whether or not, you know, if you're doing a sort of friends and family social recovery setup, I question whether or not the authentication protocols around that are going to be sufficiently strict, and that the, you know, guardians, if you will, of the recovery process are going to be, you know, well vetted in understanding, you know, how to think adversarially and not let themselves be compromised. And there's also just this incentive issue, and this is why it's a lot more hand-wavy. Basically, I don't believe anyone has an incentive to take care of your custody setup as you. Even your friends and family. You know, I'm sure everybody's situation is different, but like when I think of myself and my friends and family, I struggle to think of a setup in which I would, you know, trust some subset of them to be, you know, key recovery custodians for me. What I'm actually more bullish on is having, you know, key recoveries as probably some sort of multi-institutional thing, where what you would actually do is, you know, you would have reputable third parties that you could distribute these recovery keys or shards or whatever across, and you could do so in such a way that, you know, you're not trusting any single one of them, you know, not to screw you over. I think that that could give us a better type of reliable setup, where we're having quote unquote professionals that are managing, you know, this private key material, but we're not fully trusting them with all the keys to the kingdom.
Thank you. I agree on that. There are a lot of people who don't enter crypto because they don't trust themselves as the custodial, but for sure it's even worse idea to trust some of your friends that they will that they will better keep your private keys rather than institutional custodial companies that they live every day to make people keys safe. All right, we almost run out of the time. Thank you, Jameson, very much. It was insightful talk, and I hope people learned new today. We talked about CCSS standards. We talked about why proof of reserve was removed from this standard. We explained what is account abstraction and the difference between the setups of Ethereum-based wallets from the smart contract and the private key, and we explained why Casa Key solution, how it operates, and why it's probably on architecture level is most suitable to millions of people, and that this approach can get us closer to desired mass adoption. Thank you. Any closing words you want to say, please feel free.
Yeah, my main thing is, you know, I've been doing the same type of engineering for 8 years now, you know, just trying to help people deal with private keys. Meanwhile, you know, the rest of this space, there's an incredible amount of innovation. You know, people are doing some really crazy cutting edge stuff. But I think, you know, it all rests upon this foundation of being able to have people, you know, regular people, be confident in self-custody. Like that is why we are here. You know, trusted third parties are security holes. And so I feel like there's still a lot of work to be done to get people into self-custody setups to, you know, help them understand that they're exposing themselves to a lot of risks when they're keeping their money at a third party. And, you know, the sort of the old world paradigm of keeping all your money in a quote unquote bank with someone else is no longer necessary.
Thank you. Thank you for all your work that you've been doing and safeguarding so many people. And yeah, please leave comments with questions under this post. And me and Jameson, for sure, we will try to answer them. Thank you once again and have a good day, everybody.